Richard Thompson began his career as a guitarist and a songwriter when he was still a teenager, and six decades on, his passion for making and sharing music is as strong as ever. In the late 1960s, he co-founded the pioneering folk rock band Fairport Convention. In 1969 alone, they released three albums. All featured the voice of Sandy Denny, and one, Liege and Leaf, was later acclaimed as the most influential folk album of all time. In the early 70s, Richard left the band to form a decade-long musical partnership with his then-wife, Linda. He's now spent over 30 years as a solo artist, winning an Ivor Novello Award for songwriting, a Lifetime Achievement Award from BBC Radio 2, and countless plaudits for his guitar playing. Richard, you've brought to us today a wide array of music, including Beethoven, Purcell, Britten. But actually, we're going to start with the guitar and Manuel de Falla. Why is it important for you?
A guitar appeared in my house probably when I was 10 years old. My father's old army buddy was working in one of the guitar shops in Charing Cross Road and said, "We've got this guitar, it's a Spanish guitar, it's a bit smashed up. You know, you're a woodworker, you could repair it and you can have it." And my father was in the police, so that was his beat, really. And he brought this guitar home, which was damaged. He repaired it and he had his eyes on it to play it. He was a sort of amateur dance band guitarist. And my sister thought she might play it, and I thought I might play it. And I grabbed it, and I thought, this is great. This is what I want. And my parents thought, well, if you're going to play that thing, let's get serious about it, and let's give you some classical lessons. So myself and my neighbour used to go on the bus to the Caledonian Road and have our Spanish guitar lesson, which is wonderful. That lasted about a year. And then one day we turned up for our lesson, and the house wasn't there. It'd just been demolished. I think it was condemned anyway. The fact we were having guitar lessons by candlelight should have been an indication that not everything was exactly connected to the grid. So my father, knowing I enjoyed classical music, one day he brought home an EP of Ida Presti and Alexandra Lagoya. And this was one of the sides of that EP. This is La Vida Breve by Manuel de Falla. This is the first Spanish dance, and it's a duet, it's a guitar duet. Ida Presti played with her husband, Alexandra Lagoya, probably the greatest guitar duet ever recorded. I don't think that they've been surpassed by anybody, but I love Ida Presti's sensitivity, her passion, something I've always tried to emulate. Such a wonderful musician. So here we go. The first dance from La Vida Breve. Thank you.
Spanish Dance by Manuel de Falla from the opera La Vida Breve, performed by Alexander Lagoya and Ida Presti. I wonder, Richard Thompson, to what extent that sound of the quintessential Spanish guitar influenced the sound that you went on to make in your guitar playing.
I think quite a lot. Somewhere between Ida Presti and Django Reinhardt, I think that kind of passion is very beautiful and kind of satisfies my soul anyway. That's been a big influence on my playing.
You were born in Notting Hill, and I wonder what your memories of early life in London are. Happy ones?
I mean, fairly happy. When we lived just off Ladbroke Grove, the street was fairly bombed during the war, so all the buildings were pockmarked by shrapnel, and at the end of the street was a bomb site, which, of course, as kids, we just loved playing on, all the broken glass and brick. The detritus of people's lives just kind of left there. But as kids, you think, well, this is a playground. But we were fairly close to Portobello Market, which was kind of exciting at the time, and to Wormwood Scrubs as a park, so that was nice. But when I was five, we moved to Highgate. Then you had Hampstead Heath and a lot more open space, and I had a lot more friends too, which was nice.
And did you continue with your guitar playing?
I didn't. In my class at school, we had two other kids who were classical guitar players who were better than me. This is when I'm 13, 14, I'm thinking this is a crowded field. There was Carlos Bunnell, who became a professional musician, a young kid called Paul Lomax, who was on the Tonight programme at the age of 14. He didn't pursue a classical career, but I thought, this is crazy. I'm going to sidestep over to folk and rock. It's an easier field.
And you actually had a band at school, didn't you?
I had a band with Hugh Cornwell, who was in a band called The Stranglers, who were quite successful in the punk era. Hugh and I are still in touch and plan projects together. But it was just so exciting to be able to play music. And to be in a band, you learn from the other musicians. Even if you're not very good, you kind of pick things up from each other. And it's a great learning experience.
And did you hear much classical music at that point?
It was bitty. My parents took me to one of those big Albert Hall family galas when I was about seven, I suppose. And it was 1812 with real canon and Tchaikovsky's Piano Concerto, Course of the Hebrew Slaves, etc., etc. I remember John Ogden was the pianist. I was very impressed with that. And when, I think when I was about 14, I heard Debussy, and I thought, well, this is absolutely fantastic. I love the ambiguity of this music. So I went out and bought La Mer. It was in mono, and it wasn't the clearest of recordings. And also on the family gramophone, it all just sounded a bit kind of dull, and there wasn't a lot of equalization available in those days. So I got used to hearing Debussy as very sort of misty. And when I went to hear it live, I was a bit shocked. You could actually hear the trumpets, and you could actually hear sort of clarity. I thought, this is wrong. It shouldn't sound like this.
And presumably you were hearing a certain amount of traditional Scottish music.
Well, I grew up with traditional Scottish music, yes. My grandmother was from the Isle of Skye, so she'd sing in Gaelic, around the house when I'd go and visit my grandparents. My father was a typical exiled Scot in that he was more Scottish than Scottish people. And so he'd always do Burns Night. There'd always be a big dance at our house on New Year's Eve. So yeah, you had a lot of Scottish dance music, a lot of Jimmy Shand. My sister had some folk records as well. And then probably when I was about 15 and I could sneak into pubs, I'd go to our local folk club and I'd hear people like Martin Carthy, the Watersons, Davy Graham, Bert Jancher, wonderful revivalists, I suppose, really, and very good guitar players.
This next track, I think, was a favourite at home.
Yes, my father had an interesting record collection, some very good jazz. He had Louis Armstrong, Duke Ellington, and he had the guitar players. He had Les Paul and Django Reinhardt with the quintet. And this track, Caravan, when I first heard this, I must have been about three or two, or, I don't even remember how young I actually was. And I thought, well, this is music from outer space. This is something you might hear, vaguely in a science fiction film or something, trying to evoke alien life forms. It's at the beginning of multi-tracking. This is Les Paul, very smart technically, also a wonderful guitar player. But he's multi-tracking. He's using two disc-cutting machines and going from one to the other, overdubbing and overdubbing and overdubbing and overdubbing. And every time you do that, you lose quality. But Les was very smart. He'd only use the outside of the disc because he knew that's where the best quality was. And on this track, he plays everything. He plays the double bass, he plays the percussion, he plays the accordion, and there's about three or four guitar tracks. One's at double speed. He was just a very, very smart guy and a massive influence on popular music.
Les Paul guitars were famous, weren't they?
Les Paul guitars were famous, which was Les Paul going to the Gibson Guitar Company and saying, you know, design me a solid body guitar. He'd wind the pickups himself. He was always experiencing something. Well, when I met Les Paul, he was probably 80. And I said, that guitar you're playing, that looks a bit strange, you know, what's going on with that? And he said, oh, I'm just experimenting with something, you know, I'm just trying this different pickup. So he never stopped being an innovator. The other great thing about Les Paul is he didn't really sleep. He weren't one of those people who could do without sleep for days. And when he was in the Navy, they did a survival exercise, and they said, we want volunteers to go without sleep. We want to see how long you can do it. And Les said, put me in. I really want to do it. He did 11 days without sleep.
Good God.
11 days without sleep. So he had lots of time to innovate and and make these extraordinary recordings.
Well, here he is, Wide Awake. Extraordinary playing.
Yeah. Yeah, amazing piece.
Caravan, a number by Duke Ellington and Juan Tizol, performed there by Les Paul. Richard Thompson, you left school in 1967, and I think you had a rather unusual apprenticeship.
Yes, I worked for a graphic designer, a guy called Hans Unger, and we did London Transport posters, post office posters, and we did stained glass. And mostly I was involved in a big stained glass project, St. Columba's up in Chester. Probably only for about 6 months, but it was a wonderful experience because Hans and his partner, Eberhard Schulze, were big classical music fans. And so you could have the Radio 3 feed in the workshop, or you could have whatever was on the record player at the time. And Hans and Eberhard, they were big Wagner fans, so you might have a whole week of Wagner at some point. You might have the entire Ring. Or sometimes they'd let me choose, you know, like Vaughan Williams or something, a bit more to my taste, or Elgar, you know, and then they say, oh, that English romantic stuff, you know, honestly, you know, how can you listen to that? Or something French, and you know, they say, oh, it's too frivolous, you know, there's not enough architecture in the music. But I did get to hear a lot of classical music at that time, which was fantastic.
Well, we're going to turn to the much sneered at English tradition, yeah. Aren't we, for your next piece?
Absolutely, yeah. This is a piece by Elgar. This is The Sea Pictures, and it's five poems, one of which was written by Elgar's wife, Caroline. Poem set to music. The one we're going to listen to is Where Corals Lie. And this was a poem by Richard Garnett, who was something of an academic, actually. He did a lot of translations from Greek and Latin. And he was the British Museum keeper of printed books, which is a lovely description. I don't think they call it that anymore. And it's a beautiful piece. And I think Janet Baker did pretty much the definitive version of this. I could do a whole hour of Janet Baker. That would be just fine with me. One of the great voices. What makes a great singer? I don't know. You know, certain technical perfection, but also just connection to whatever is being sung, that emotion that connects you absolutely with the material. And I think she just had that thing.
Thank you.
two legendary performers teaming up there, John Barbirolli and Janet Baker.
Extraordinary, yeah. I think, you know, there's a great era for recording as well. You know, they used to do a lot of stuff at Watford Town Hall, which is the most unlikely of venues. Yes. But just sonically, I love 50s, 60s, early stereo.
Where Corals Lie from Elgar's Sea Pictures, performed by Janet Baker, the London Symphony Orchestra, conducted by John Barbirolli. When you were 18, Richard, you co-founded the band Fairport Convention. How did that come about?
It was neighbourhood friends, really, centred around Muswell Hill in North London. And we were something of a lyric band. We loved lyrics, and so we would find obscure records by Bob Dylan, by Leonard Cohen. We got hold of Joni Mitchell's demos before she made a record and used to cover her stuff before we became writers ourselves. And we were part, really, of the London underground scene in 67. We did a show opening for Pink Floyd, and the producer, Joe Boyd, came backstage and said, "Let's make a record," that classic phrase. We just had a wonderful time in those days. I think the audience were very open, or just stoned, one or the other. And so they're accepting of us, they're accepting of all kinds of psychedelia, they're accepting of bizarre people like Ivor Cutler, you know. It's one of those easy times to break through and to get signed to a label, and that was the beginning. It was great.
You were incredibly productive as a band. Your self-titled debut came out in 68, and then two albums, What We Did on Our Holidays and Un-Half-Bricking, the following year. It must have felt at the time that songs were beginning to sort of trip out of you.
Well, we were young. That's a good excuse. We had energy. We would just record all the time. We'd drive back from a show, maybe in Birmingham or something. We'd just go to the studio and we'd record all night, and then get in the van and drive somewhere else the next morning.
So you have something in common with Les Paul. So do you think there's an element of inspiration, the muse, which comes at a particular stage in life when everybody is sort of gelling?
I think when you're young, there's a certain energy, and I'm not sure you ever really get that back. It gets replaced by maturity and a different viewpoint, but there is that youthful state that is extraordinary, and it is energetic, and it can be that productive. But it doesn't preclude the fact that later in life you can have these points of inspiration as well. And I think I'm a better writer now than I was when I was, you know, 18. It comes and goes. You know, the muse will smile kindly on you sometimes, but really it's something that you should have your whole life. You know, I look at people like David Hockney or Gillian Ayers, you know, painters, in the studio, 80, 90, you know, like excited about their work, for them breaking new ground. And I think there's no reason why you shouldn't be absolutely full of energy and full of creativity at any age.
The singer Santi Denny joined the band with the song A Sailor's Life. You came up with the idea of mixing a traditional folk song with a rock beat. Did you realise you were onto something new? Or again, was this just the way things develop and happen quite naturally?
I think as a band, we'd experimented with playing traditional music on the previous album and live as well. But Sandy had this song that she sang to us in a dressing room before a show. And it's quite a long ballad. And we thought, well, let's just play it and see what happens. I think it was we were at Southampton University. We just played it, and it had a kind of flow to it, and it had an instrumental section to it. And we said, well, you know, this is great. So we spoke to Joe Boyd, our producer, and we said, well, you know, we want to come in the studio and we want to do this track, bring in a traditional musician. How about Dave Swarbrick? So Joe says, oh, I know Dave, sure, we'll get him on the session as well. And so Swarb had never plugged his fiddle in before, so we put a pickup on his fiddle, and he'd never played with a bunch of, you know, hooligan rock and roll musicians either. So somehow we built a bridge on that song. It was like putting the stones and the stones and the stones and building a kind of an arch and a stone in the middle that kind of joined it all together. And you can hear us feeling each other's music out, you know. And I think all we said at the beginning, before we started, was, I said to Swarby, do you think this is major or minor? And he said, well, I suppose it's both, really. So that was the basic premise for the whole thing.
Well, the music you've chosen next, actually, is the Watersons.
Yeah. I saw the Watersons in a folk club probably when I was 16, and I was knocked out. The Watersons were unusual. They weren't strictly traditional in the sense that here they're singing a ballad, and normally a ballad would just be unaccompanied, one voice. And then maybe you'd have a love song or a drinking song that would have a verse, and then everyone would join in on the chorus. But the Woodersons had a different approach that wasn't strictly traditional. So they'd harmonise things in their own unique way, singing family, two sisters, a brother and a cousin. Sometimes the girls are singing unison, sometimes they branch out. Mike Woodson's this kind of floating harmonizer. And every take is different. Even if they don't know what they're doing sometimes, they have this instinct, this great musical instinct. They just sing like a family sings. You know, you get that modular, intermodular distortion that makes it all sound so round and harmonically tight. So this is a ballad. It's called Brave Wolf. It's about General Wolf. It's about fighting the French up in Quebec in the
1759.
Yeah, thank you very much indeed. And General Wolfe gets fatally wounded. And in the ballad, it gets a bit romantic, and it says, oh, here's 100 guineas all in bright gold, you know, take it, divide it. I don't think that actually happened, but, you know, romantically speaking, this is a ballad, so you can get away with a bit of fiction.
One Monday morning as we set sail, the wind did blow a pleasant gale. To fight the French, it was our intent. Through smoke and fire. And it was a dark and a gloom. French were landed on mountains high, while we poor souls in the valley lie. Cheer up, me lads, General Wolfe did say, brave lads of honour, brave lads of honour. Broadside we gave to them, we wounded 150 men. Well done, me lads, General Wolfe did say, brave lads of honour, brave lads of honour. Broadside they gave to us, they wounded our general in his right breast, and from his breast precious blood did flow, like any fountain. And all his men were filled with woe. Here's 100 guineas all in bright gold. Take it, part it, for my love's quite cold. And use your men as you did before, your soldiers own. And they will fight forevermore. And when to friends, that I am dead, oh, that I am dead, oh, and never shall see her no more.
Very nicely balanced, those voices.
Beautiful, they? Yeah, beautiful.
Brave Wolf, performed by the Watersons. Richard Thompson, an awful thing happened in 1969 when the band was involved in a terrible accident on the M1 after a late night gig.
Yeah, yes, our drummer was killed, my girlfriend was killed. It was a very traumatic time, and we did wonder if we should carry on as a band, if that was the price that we had to pay, but we decided to basically ditch all our old repertoire and to start again. And we thought, well, let's do that album project we've been talking about, of doing a whole album of traditional music with a rock band. And let's see what happens with that. So we hid ourselves away in the country for a couple of months, did a lot of research, dug out what we thought were the best songs, rehearsed them up, added Dave Swarbrick as a permanent member of the band, and that album became Legion Leaf, which I think was a very influential record. We're quite proud of that one.
It's an obvious question in a sense, but I mean, presumably music was a help to get through that terrible grief.
I think we had undiagnosed PTSD for years, actually, after that. But it was still close enough to World War II that people said, well, OK, you know, pull yourself up, you know, stiff upper lip and all that, you know, come on, get on with it. There wasn't this sense of, oh, you need counselling, you need therapy, which would have been probably a better idea. So I think we made bad decisions. A lot of people left the band at that time. I left in 1970, Sandy left, Ashley left, and I don't think that necessarily would have happened if we hadn't had that trauma.
Do you look back on Legion Leaf now with affection?
I think it's a really important record. Is it my favourite Fairport record? Probably not. I think the one before is a better record, but I think Legion Leaf really affected the whole landscape of traditional music in the UK and how you interpret it. It also influenced people in other countries, which is interesting, like people in Spain, people in North America heard this record and said, we should do the same thing with our own tradition.
I'm really thrilled that you've chosen this next piece because I think it's slightly undervalued in the Debussy oeuvre, La Mer, L'Après-Midi, so popular. But I know Simon Rattle and indeed Mark Elder, who's conducting here, rated as high as those pieces, if not higher.
Yeah, I think it's possibly more complex than either of those, and those are complex pieces anyway. It's called Jeu. It has a playfulness to it, but also has an extraordinary depth to it and a harmonic complexity that takes a while to unravel, I should say. But it's just a beautiful piece.
Thank you.
the opening of Jeux by Claude Debussy, performed by the Halle Orchestra, conducted by Mark Holder. There is an ethereal, electrical quality to it, isn't it? It was originally going to be a ballet, Jeux, and it's about the tennis players searching for a lost ball, which sounds a bit incongruous, but that was the kind of thing that happened in those days.
Interesting, okay. I would try to put those images out of my mind, actually, when I'm listening to it. It's a wonderful, elusive piece of music. Changes key so many times, it changes texture so many times.
I saw you really concentrating on the sound, and you do have to, don't you? With some pieces, you just have to listen so carefully for all the gradations. It's like looking at a painting or something as the colours just change very slightly.
Yeah, well, every time I hear this piece, I hear different things. You know, as a piece of orchestration, it's so interesting as well. And I'm always thinking, well, how do they do that? How do they get that effect, that sound?
You left Fairport Convention, Richard Thompson, in 1970, did lots of session work, began a career with Linda Peters, who became your wife, in 1972. And how did you two meet?
We met probably through Sandy Denny, who was the singer in Fairport. Linda and Sandy were great friends. At some point, we just connected and started going out together. And Linda had a career as a singer, and I had a career as a guitarist and composer. And at some point, we said, well, we hardly see each other. We're always working in different things. Let's just team up and play together, and then at least we'll get to spend a bit more time with each other. So that's really what happened. And we played in folk clubs for a year, then we did more concert work. And it was a 10-year working relationship and marriage as well, but it was productive.
You and Linda discovered Sufism, didn't you?
Yeah. Well, I think I've been looking for a spiritual path really since I was about 16. I used to hang out in Watkins Bookshop in Cecil Court in London and read my way through the shelves. But I thought the Sufis really had some knowledge, and I was particularly attracted to the Sufis in North Africa. And I still have that connection. And yeah, in the 70s, everyone was seeking. A lot of gurus appeared. A lot of people were looking for some kind of spirituality in their lives, you know.
And at 23, you became Muslim.
Yes, yes.
And are you still?
Yes.
And has that offered you the kind of religious experience, spiritual experience you were looking for?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a way to steer through the shark-infested waters of the music business, if you like, to understand life and to understand what happens maybe after life. So for me, it answers all the questions. Mm. Other people may choose different paths.
You moved to Suffolk, and that takes us very nicely to our next composer.
Yeah, my mother's family comes from Suffolk. They were the Garretts and the Garrett Andersons. And bizarrely, probably my great-great-uncle actually built Snake Maltings. He was a brewer, and he built it as a place to dry the hops out. And his daughter became the first woman mayor in Britain. She was the mayor of Aldborough, Elizabeth Garrett Anderson. And then she became the first woman doctor.
Named after her.
And the other branch of the family were locomotive engineers who built the Bear Garrett locomotives that went round corners on mountain railways in South America and Africa. So it was an interesting side of the family.
And what do you feel about the music of Benjamin Britten? Is it very much for you the music of that coastline?
Well, it's very particular to that place. And you know, I spent time in Aldborough and South Wold and Walberswick and all up the coast there and around Snape as well. It's just a beautiful part of the coast, and it's so evocative of that time and place. I love Peter Grimes. It's one of my favourite operas, I think one of the great operas of the 20th century. And so much of Benjamin Britten's work just resonates with me. I love it.
This first piece, From the Sea Interludes, is a wonderful evocation of dawn, isn't it?
Oh my goodness, yeah. And of the sea as well, just extraordinary.
And wonderful use of the orchestra and the clarinet.
Oh, yeah. Polytonalism creeps in here. Things appear in different keys sometimes, which is all part of the evocation.
And then as the sun begins to warm, you get that wonderfully warm chord on the brass.
Thank you.
Dawn, the first of Benjamin Britten's 4C interludes from the opera Peter Grimes, performed by the Bergen Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Neyma Järvi. You and Linda divorced in 1982, and you began a solo career, regularly touring in America. What did you like about living there, so different from Suffolk?
It's very different. Well, I lived in California, and it was rather seductive. I think if you're a Brit and you've lived through the grey days of a British winter, you think, God, this is like paradise. This is fantastic. So that was seductive. But I think these days you can be almost anywhere in the world. You can be at the South Pole, you know, you can be absolutely anywhere and be very British. You've got the football and the cricket, and you can just stay totally connected. And I don't think I ever succumbed to American culture in terms of the music that I expressed.
Music from Russia next. It's Shostakovich.
Yes, I love Shostakovich. Of course, a great friend of Benjamin Britten as well. The string quartets just kill me. They're absolutely wonderful. Symphonies are wonderful. And A Strange Life, you know, with Joseph Stalin looking over your shoulder all the time. This is Prelude and Scherzo, which I think is fairly early. It's like 1927, I think. He wrote it, I think, as a memorial to a young poet who was killed. It's not that well known. And I'm grateful to my friend Peter Eskim, who conducts the Raleigh Symphony, for turning me onto this piece. And it's an octet. I think it's just a stunning piece.
Thank you.
Thank you.
He's very good at those dynamic rhythms, isn't he?
Fantastic, yeah. It's a piece has a lot of movement to it.
And interestingly, Richard Thompson, that you've brought together Britten and Shostakovich, because, of course, not only did they share the same humanitarian aspirations, but they were two composers at the edge of tonality, using bitonality, in fact, very often.
Yeah, to me, that's in some ways the most interesting place to be. You know, in my own music, you know, I write songs that are fairly orthodox, but then if I get to play guitar on those songs, sometimes I can go places. You know, it's uncharted waters, flow freely over whatever the structure may be. I can get dissonant sometimes.
The Prelude and Scherzo, two pieces for string octet, written by Dmitri Shostakovich, performed by the Potsdam Chamber Academy, conducted by Michael Sandling. Do you find a great difference in hearing music live? I mean, especially with music like that, where this tactile bow hitting the string is so exciting.
Yeah, I love to watch live music. I've seen this piece live and it's just wonderful to experience that. And you get more dynamic as well somehow, sitting there in front of it. I love to watch orchestras working anyway. I love to see who's playing what, you know, at what time, what instruments are combining, forming sections, how that flows into a whole piece. It's the best thing.
The craft of songwriting, Richard, is clearly very important to you, and you've taught it with your son, Jack.
Yes, my two sons and my grandson and I run a songwriting camp up in Woodstock, New York, every summer. This will be our 12th year, I think.
Is it possible to teach songwriting, or is it something that's just innate, that's there?
You can teach all around it. You probably can't actually teach it. I suppose you can say, this is the mindset you need. This is the range of possibilities. But then it's up to you. And I think often the best way to teach it is to say, OK, here's the parameters for this particular song. I want you to go away and write something that has four chords and it's a heartbreak song. And people come back and then you can kind of critique it in a gentle, encouraging way and say, OK, maybe you should repeat that chorus. Maybe you should get rid of those two lines. They're superfluous. I think we might even just teach almost a philosophy of music. This is what we like. We hope you like it too.
Do you have any particular methodology yourself when you're writing, or does it just come when you're sitting down working?
I think it's good to have different ways into the process. You have to get your mind in a certain state, I think, to be creative. I think I'm now better at getting to that place, getting to the bottom of the ladder. You know, I use all different ways of doing it. Sitting an instrument, not sitting an instrument, walking down the street. Sometimes you're just driven to write something about something that happened to you or happened to a friend of yours or something you read on the news. You just have to express it. And I think to have longevity as a songwriter, you have to be driven somehow. You know, you have to have demons from your past or something driving you onwards.
And is that what you'd say to an aspiring young songwriter listening to us today, that you just have to keep at it, basically?
Well, you surely have to keep at it. As Picasso said, the muse will find you, but it likes to find you working. So I think you have to meet the muse halfway. Yeah, you can't just sit there and wait for the bolt of lightning to strike you.
Talking of muses, it's Maria Callas next.
Well, couldn't not have Maria Callas in there somewhere. Goodness gracious. Well, I tried to not pick, you know, the most obvious Maria Callas choices, but she was extraordinary, absolutely extraordinary. I mean, a great dramatic singer, a dramatic actress who inhabited the song. And if there is such a thing as musical intelligence, then she had it in spades. She just sang the right thing at the right time with the right degree of emotion. Absolutely extraordinary.
Thank you. She gets such drama into the actual texture of the sound, doesn't she?
Absolutely. Very close indeed. Such an emotional performance.
Eben Neandro Lontana from the opera La Vallée, composed by Alfredo Catalani and performed there by Maria Callas. In 2004, you created the soundtrack for the documentary Grizzly Man, directed by Werner Herzog, which chronicles the life and death of the bear enthusiast and conservationist Timothy Treadwell. What was it like to work with Herzog on that?
It was very interesting. We used a different process than I would have chosen, but it worked very well. Normally, you do a score and play the score, usually to picture. Werner said, well, I don't want you to work to picture. I want you to time the piece, look at the piece, and then create a piece of music that survives on its own merits.
So there's a lot of improvisation involved?
The whole thing's improvised, completely improvised. We had very good improvisatory musicians in the studio. We had 5-6 musicians. And, you know, I'm looking into the studio through the glass there, and I'm saying, you know, this is a 38-second cue. When it gets to the end, you know, count me down 10 seconds from the end, and I'll try and wrap it up. And that's what we did, and it actually worked extraordinarily well. We did the whole thing in a day and a half.
Purcell next.
Ooh, okay, Henry Purcell. If I never wrote a note of music, I would say, well, I don't have to, because Purcell's written it all for me. He reads my mind somehow from the 1600s. I just find his music perfect in so many ways. The piece we're going to hear is just the overture from a very, very perfect opera.
One of the first operas.
Exactly, a very early opera, and there's just nothing wrong with it. It's just absolutely wonderful. It's a tragedy, Dido and Aeneas. It's heartbreaking stuff. And this is just the overture, and it's a short overture. And sometimes when you're sitting in the audience, you think, if only all overtures were this short. It's absolutely to the point. It absolutely sets the scene for what's about to happen.
The overture from Dido and Aeneas by Henry Purcell, performed by the Academy of Ancient Music, conducted by Christopher Hogwood. Richard Thompson, Ship to Shore is your 20th solo album, and I thought we couldn't have you here without hearing a little burst of it.
Well, that'd be lovely, thank you.
So here is a little moment from Freeze.
Another day without a dream, without a hope, without a scheme. Another day to find you crawling on your knees. Your face up to the sun, you blow a kiss to kingdom come, you say goodbye to everyone and then you freeze. Well, if you left, this all had changed, full of the wonderful and strange. You run with all us chasing rabbits into holes. Your life was narrow, it was mean, dogs fly off your souls. You're going forward from backwards. Good are the opera for creepers. Dark are the thoughts that invade you. Dark as the shades on your fingers.
Freeze, actually so many of the things you've been talking about are there.
Oh, good.
You know, I mean, folk music, rock music, and the interesting scale there. Da da dee 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 dee.
Yeah, with the flat five, yeah. Well, good. I'm glad it rubbed off eventually.
You wrote your autobiography, Beeswing, in 2021. How do you look back on the early years now? Do you still feel a connection with that time, or do you feel you're in another time?
I think both. I think if you're a songwriter and you're a performing songwriter, you may be performing songs for when you're 18 years old, which is strange, on a nightly basis as well. And that's a curious thing. Maybe that only happens with certain professions. So there's always that connection, but there's always the feeling that you want to drive on, you want to see what's in the future. Well, it's exciting, you know. It's exciting to know what's around the next corner. And you're always a student. Yeah, you're always learning.
The music industry has changed beyond all belief now. Is it for the better? Is it easier or harder to be a musician now?
Well, it's strange. It's just different. I think in the old days, you would sign to a label and they would pretty much own you. And the contracts were ridiculous. So that was tough. But on the other hand, you had all that support. You had in-house publicists and promotion and legal and everything inside the record company. Now you're on your own.
And it's more difficult to make money in some ways because streaming pays such a tiny amount.
Oh, it's way harder. Yeah, I mean, streaming's made most of our lives very difficult. Which is why you see so many people who would probably like to retire are still on the road, because that's the only place they can earn money. I think royalties used to be probably 50% of my income, and it's now about 2% of my income. It's that drastic.
You're still performing live concerts at the age of 75. Do you need an audience, or would you be just as happy sitting at home songwriting?
Well, I love the various processes that I go through. I love composing, I love recording. But the best thing of all is to play music in front of an audience and feel that you've communicated something, and feel that something's gone from your heart to their hearts.
We've come to your final piece of music. What is it and why is it here?
This is Beethoven. It's the late quartets, which are something very special. In these quartets, I think he's going places you hadn't been before, as you'd expect, endlessly creative. Whole new ways of thinking melodically, whole new ways of thinking harmonically, and pointing the way to probably, you know, the later Romantic composers, people like Tchaikovsky and Mahler. And this is number 16, which is the last one. This is a place to go when you need some calm, when you need to get away from the helter-skelter of life, the hurly-burly, to just sit in a room with a nice sound system and just play this. It's like a big exhalation. And also, for me, it's a kind of confirmation of life, you know, it's a confirmation of us as human beings, that you can have all kinds of terrible politics on the one side of the scale, and then you have to balance it, you have Beethoven on the other side.
Well, it's a very nice note on which to say thank you very much indeed, Richard Thompson.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.